Today is Sunday. It's November 8th, 2020. This is part 3 of a Grand Canyon oral history with Carl Bowman, spelled B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Carl. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. Enjoying the fact that we're finally getting some precipitation.
Yes, I'm watching the snow fall out the window as we speak, and we're just thrilled after months and months of drought.
Really?
Terrible. Hey, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You sure can.
Thank you. We wrapped up part 2, where you were getting ready to leave Petrified Forest National Park in northern Arizona for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park in Alaska. Had you ever been to Alaska before?
No, I had. excuse me, I'd never even been to the Pacific Northwest.
Okay, so. And so you're gonna drive your, you've got this pickup truck, right?
Well, I actually put that in storage.
Okay.
Loaded up. It was great for the tires. Loaded up all my personal belongings and drove it into a storage shed in New Mexico, and. Loaded everything I thought I'd need for the summer into a backpack, a duffel bag, and a footlocker. And then flew from Albuquerque to Seattle to Juneau. And then took the state ferry from Juneau up to Skagway.
Okay. So getting out of the plane in Juneau, what was that like?
It was, well... I don't know if you've ever flown into Juneau. The airport there is in the bottom of a glacial valley.
Oh wow!
And so there's some real acrobatics to get in and take off. They do cut down the trees on some of the neighboring hills so that the planes can clear them before they take off. But once you land in Juneau, you're pretty happy to be on the ground.
Yeah. Did you get sick flying in?
No, I didn't. Until the last few minutes of terror. Why, you know, it's a pretty nice flight.
Oh my gosh! Wow. So I'm assuming, again, never having been there, I haven't flown that death-defying flight into the airport. Big trees.
Yeah, it was. At that time, the airport was. Kind of on the edge of Juneau. Juneau's grown up since then, but it's out on the edge of Juneau, and so you've got the big forests, the fir trees, the Douglas fir and spruce, Sitka spruce, and growing right down to the water's edge.
Wow!
And then timberline in that area is about 2,000 feet, so you've got the if the clouds are high enough, you can see easily above timberline, and very peaceful, calm water. It's the Inside Passage. There's a archipelago there that pretty much blocks the storms, the big waves and stuff, most of the time from coming in there.
So you have your trunk and your backpack and your duffel bag. And
yep.
You've got to get to the ferry.
Yep. I had spent the night in the hotel there in Juneau.
Oh, okay.
And then got a taxi. I don't remember now, but anyway, got to the ferry terminal, hauled all my stuff onto the state ferry, and the state ferries up there are. Pretty much, well, they call it the Alaska Marine Highway System. It's basically the roadway that connects the towns in southeast Alaska.
Okay.
Because there aren't any roads in. The only road at that time coming into southeast Alaska came in way up at the north end of the panhandle in the town of Haines.
Okay.
And so everybody got around on the state ferry if you were going from town to town. I made a couple of trips over the course of the summer. And you'd be on there with tourists and high school basketball teams.
Oh, wow.
You know, folks doing stuff. Most people didn't even take a car because, except for Juneau, the towns in southeast Alaska are pretty small, and you can just walk around.
Okay.
And what I learned as the summer went on was, if you were going to Juneau, you just made friends with somebody else that was going to Juneau, so they'd give you a ride.
Okay.
You go someplace. Well, once you got there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we took the ferry, left in the morning, and headed up to Skagway, and it was absolutely beautiful. You know, just going up through the fjords, waterfalls.
Wow.
Coming down these glacial valleys and all that, and then Skagway is pretty much the end of the line. It's the last fjord up there at the north end of southeast Alaska.
Okay.
And got off the ferry, and fortunately the park visitor center was maybe a quarter mile from the ferry terminal, so I could schlep all my stuff up there and find out where they were going to put me.
Okay. And so the last I'm assuming mid-afternoon you showed up.
Yeah, I think so. I don't for sure remember the time of day, but it was,
okay.
I think it was.
So you had to scurry over there your quarter mile with all your gear before they closed up shop for the day.
Yep. And
marched in and said, "Hi, my name's Carl."
And it's a small enough town that, you know, they knew somebody was coming.
Okay.
Lugging all that stuff up the street. And at that time, that was actually the first summer that Klondike Gold Rush was a park there in Skagway.
Ah.
It was prior to that, while they were studying the feasibility of the park, it was there were offices there that were manned as kind of an offshoot of Glacier Bay, which at that time was a national monument.
Okay.
So the Park Service had been there, and there had been a proposal to establish this park, and the park was actually an international park. There were the Klondike gold fields were actually up in the Yukon in Canada, and so there were United States had units in Seattle, where most of the gold rushers left from, and then in Skagway and Dyea. Dyea is now a ghost town, but Skagway is still there, and that's where most of the gold rushers disembarked. And then the Chilkoot Trail that ran up from Dyea over the international boundary into Canada and down to a lake, Bennett Lake, which is part of the headwaters of the Yukon. And and then the other unit in Alaska was the ruins, the site of another town called White Pass City, which was on the White Pass Trail that went up also to Lake Bennett. And then at Lake Bennett, the gold rushers had cobbled together boats and looked down the Yukon to the Klondike. And then
wow.
Canada had had parks also on the Chilkoot Trail, and then at Dawson Creek, which was where the Klondike Gold Rush was.
Okay.
So we disembarked at that time. Skagway had a population of about 600, so it was a pretty small town.
Let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
The Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park, as a what was the term that you used? Two countries were participating in it.
Is that
maybe
That's right.
Canada and the United States. Did the Canada land include the trail and you know down the Yukon? Did it include all that land?
I'm not sure. I know that the Canadian Park had the trails down to Lake Bennett. I think they may have had some sort of a unit in Whitehorse, which is the capital of the Yukon Territory.
Okay.
And the Yukon River runs right through there. And then they they had some some units up there in Dawson, but I'm not sure. Dawson is still a town, and so I'm not sure just exactly how their park integrated into the town of Dawson.
Okay.
On the U.S. units, Dyea was a ghost town. In fact, most of it was there. There just wasn't anything out there.
How do you spell Dyea?
D-Y-E-A.
Okay.
And that's how we could tell if somebody was new, because if they just came off the ferry, they'd call it Dia.
Huh. Dia, yeah.
So you'd always know if somebody was new, because they'd say, can you tell me how to get to Dia from here?
Uh-huh. And you say, no, it's Dyea. Uh-huh.
And then...
Wow.
Yeah, just as kind of a quick background on the park. The gold rush itself was in 1898. The gold was discovered right at the end of there was a financial panic in the United States at the time. And so everybody rushed to the gold fields to escape poverty.
Hmm.
The problem was that the gold had been discovered a year previous. And so over the course of the winter, the prospectors who were already up there had pretty much staked all the claims along the gold-bearing portions of the Yukon, and especially Dawson Creek. And so all these gold rushers came up and got to the Klondike gold fields, and there just wasn't much left to claim. And a lot of them just chalked it up to a great adventure and turned around and came back home again. But other prospectors fanned out all over Alaska. When they steamed up from Seattle, they could come into either Skagway or Dyea, and then go over the White Pass Trail from Skagway or the Chilkoot Trail from Dyea. Chilkoot Trail had, and Dyea got kind of the first jump on the gold rushers. Basically, Canada, wisely, I think, required all of the gold rushers to have a year's supplies.
Whoa.
When they went into Canada. They wouldn't let them into Canada until they had a year's worth of supplies. And so these guys would just shuttle material up to the border until they had about 2 tons. It took about 2 tons to satisfy all the qualifications. 2 tons of material stockpiled at the border. Then they'd go to the Mounties, and the Mounties would let them into Canada, and then they'd shuttle all this stuff down from the passes in the mountains down to Lake Bennett, where they would build boats and then float across Lake Bennett and down the Yukon River to the Klondike. Needless to say, shuttling a couple of tons worth of supplies up to the mountain passes was a pretty big job, and one of the most iconic pictures of the whole gold rush was what was called the Golden Stairs, and it was the last climb up to the pass on the Chilkoot Trail, and you see the pictures of all those miners under those heavy packs,
yeah,
with a string of black people going up a white snowfield.
Yeah.
And that's what they were doing, was shuttling their stuff up. And that's actually the trail that I worked on while I was there. Eventually, Dyea put in an aerial tram up to the pass, and so the gold rushers started preferring to come to Dyea because they could pay to tram their stuff up there instead of having to lug it up on their back. Skagway's trail up the White Pass was supposedly a stock trail, and it was informally referred to as the Dead Horse Trail, which tells you just how good it was for stock. Mm. But Skagway, I guess you could say, took the long view and eventually got a railroad up through the White Pass. Well, the railroad was even better than the tramway. And so the Chilkoot Trail and Dyea gradually withered away. The traffic started going in over the White Pass. And by the time the railroad was done, the gold rush itself was pretty much over.
Yeah.
But the railroad stayed in business because it became the link from interior Canada, northern British Columbia, and especially the Yukon Territory to BC.
Okay.
And even when I was there, the railroad was still running. They were still hauling metal ores. I can't remember what it was. I know part of it was lead. But from the mines in Canada out to the coast to be shipped out, and then supplies would come in and go over on the railroad to the Yukon.
I'm just backing up here a minute trying to work out the math. 2 tons of stuff, if you could carry 50-pound pack, you'd do that twice for 100 pounds. You'd do that 20 times for 1,000 pounds. You'd do it 40 times for a ton, and you do it 80 times for 2 tons. Is that right?
Well, it would, but their packs were heavier. They would lots of times be slogging along under 80 to 100-pound packs.
Wow, so that's 40 trips at 100 pounds.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It was quite the ordeal. And there were, I talked about Skagway and Dyea. There were settlements along the way as well. They weren't, at the time they called them towns. They called one of them a city. But really they were just way stations.
Right.
And so on the Chilkoot Trail where I worked, there was a way station about 8 miles up called Canyon City, and then another one about another 8 miles beyond that, not far below the summit of the pass at Sheep Camp, and then on the Skagway side there was one called White Pass City, and then there was a settlement at Dawson Lake, where they were all building the boats to float down the river.
Wow, which is like, you got to cut down your own tree, you've got to make your own, boards, you're going to make a scow or some kind of boat and patch it so it doesn't leak as soon as you put it in the water, and good luck.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it had to be good enough. There were some rapids along the way. And coming into Whitehorse, there was a, gosh, I can't remember the name of it. There was a narrow gorge that I did visit at one point. We'll get to that part of the story later, but where the current through the gorge, the entire Yukon squeezes down into this channel that's only about, maybe 75, 100 feet wide.
Wow.
And you can actually, I'm not sure if you can see it because you know that it's there, or you can see it because it's so obvious, but the river actually bulges up in the middle.
Wow.
Because of the strength of the current going through there.
Wow.
So they had to build boats that could at least survive well enough to get through a little bit of rough water. Nothing like Grand Canyon, but still some rough water.
Still, yeah. So you've got your gear and you struggle into the visitor center, and then what happens?
Okay, well then they assigned me a place, and basically what had happened, the citizens of Skagway had to approve the establishment of the park in their town. And so the Skagway unit was a bunch of lots that the Park Service had bought and some historic buildings the Park Service had bought. And so they put us up in these old buildings. That was our seasonal housing.
Do you have like a wood stove for heat?
What's that?
Did you have a wood stove for heat?
No, my stove was fuel oil.
Okay.
And it was also a hot water heater. And we were in a building that originally had housed the newspaper. And the downstairs was still empty. The upstairs had been refurbished enough that it was, there was a living room, a bedroom, and a bathroom, kitchen, dining room, living room combination. And you could lay on the bed and look up, and you could see the sky between the wall and the ceiling. So So they've worked on the buildings, but they weren't completely stabilized yet.
I see. A little drafty.
Yeah, they were, but it was summertime. And Skagway's not far enough to, north to have midnight sun. So the sun set about 11 o'clock and came up about 2 when I got there.
Wow.
Never really got dark. There were three of us? Yeah, three of us in my side of the house, and then the upstairs of that building actually had two apartments that were kind of mirror images of each other. And there, so there were three of us on one side and three of us on the other.
Hmm.
And we got to work cleaning the place up, and I'd never been a person that could sleep when it was light outside.
Oh, no.
But after I'd been there for about a week, I learned how to sleep when it was broad daylight outside.
Cool.
Just kind of collapsed. So we went in, got ourselves straightened out. We were right on the main drag through Skagway. A lot of the, if you go to the Skagway website and you see the Arctic Brotherhood Hall that's built out of, or it's, facade is built out of chunks of driftwood, and there's a old Golden North Hotel with this gold, what do you call it, onion dome cupola on top of it.
Huh.
Those were just right across the street from us, and all the tourists would wander up and down outside of our house. There was a curio shop across the street. Whenever the cruise ships were in, they'd play the Robert Service poems at full volume out on the street.
Oh, boy. That's conductive to sleep.
What's that?
That's conductive to sleep.
Oh, yeah. Well, the cruise ships were only there in the daytime. So,
okay.
So it was more just an annoyance than anything. Although I can't recite the Cremation of Sam McGee or Dangerous Dan McGrew or whatever anymore, but I could. So I'd been hired up there. The park staff was, like I say, it was their first year as an official park unit. And so there were some interpreters. And one of my roommates was the law enforcement person. Park Service wasn't real big on training for law enforcement anymore. So his previous experience was that he was a shuttle bus driver in Denali National Park.
Okay.
But he was the patrol ranger, and some maintenance crew, and then I was a park technician, which normally would be like a ranger. But the superintendent had decided that laborers were too expensive in Alaska, because they were just finishing up the Trans-Alaska pipeline. So, you know, labor was in short supply, pay scale was high, and so he decided that for the trail crew that summer, rather than hire laborers, he would hire park technicians.
Hmm.
So there were four of us. None of us knew a thing about building trail.
Wow.
So we went to the usual park orientation, you know, working for the National Park Service and the resources of Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park and all that kind of stuff, and filled out forms and signed paperwork and all that. And then we spent 3 days hiking the Chilkoot Trail for our orientation, which was just tremendous. You know, we started out, we hiked all the way up to the pass and then down through Canada, and out to Lake Bennett, where the trail intersected the railroad, and then took the train back into Skagway.
Wow.
And so that was, in terms of an immersive park orientation, that's probably the best one I ever had.
Nice.
And
you were bringing along a tent and sleeping bag and food? And, or
well,
were these day were these day sections?
It was an overnight backpacking trip. I remember the park did have a good supply of stuff, so
okay.
we didn't have to use our I used my own sleeping bag, but the park had packs and that sort of thing for us.
Oh, okay.
And so, and then the Chilkoot Trail had cabins along the way. I think probably kind of like what you would see on the Appalachian Trail, although I've never done the Appalachian Trail, but it was a, there was a cabin at Canyon City. There was a cabin at Sheep Camp. And so a lot of us could get inside the cabin where there were bunks and a wood stove. And then whoever didn't fit inside the cabin could sleep outside in tents. Once we got on the Canadian side, then we were all in tents. Hmm. And that was, I believe that was our last night, but I'm not positive. So we went up over the trail and then from my standpoint, it was great because I was going to be working on the trail. And came back into town, and then the next week, our boss came in and told us, okay, we're flying your supplies up to Sheep Camp. That's where we're going to base you out of. So tomorrow morning, I want you to have everything, all your food and everything that you want to have up at Sheep Camp ready for the helicopter to fly out because we're just doing one flight.
Okay.
It was kind of like, oh, my God. So there were two grocery stores in town, but fortunately they were kind of equipped to outfit people. And so the four of us who had just met a few days previously all of a sudden are trying to figure out what we want to eat for the rest of the summer.
Wait. I'm just thinking, okay, you're on trails. This is going to be like an 8-6. You've got 8 days on, 6 days off. You're saying you had to figure this out for the entire summer? You had to buy a summer's worth of food?
That was, we didn't have to, but whatever we didn't fly in, we'd have to pack in.
Whoa.
On our backs every tour that we went up the trail.
Okay. That's incentive.
Well, we weren't all that imaginative. So once we were up there, we ate a lot of Spam and baked beans and applesauce, and we'd just flown cases of that up to Sheep Camp. but we headed on up the trail. The biggest problem that we had, though, was that, like I said, none of us really knew anything about trail building, down to the fact that none of us had ever even run a chainsaw before.
Oh, wow.
And so our boss came up. He was the chief of maintenance, even though we weren't laborers. We worked for him. And he spent a couple days with us, you know, showing us how to run a chainsaw and, you know, trying hopefully how to be safe with it. And, you know, other things that we needed to know for building trail, how to corduroy, put log sections down across boggy places and that sort of thing. And he did come out and assist us a few other times over the course of the summer. But most of the time we were just on our own because his other responsibility was these historic buildings in Skagway. And the historic buildings in Skagway literally were ready to collapse.
Wow.
And so we have a trail crew out here of ignorant ignorant guys from the lower 48, and then he had a work crew of laborers that were working on stabilizing the buildings. Well, if the buildings fell down, they were gone. If the trail fell apart, they could rebuild the trail. So, needless to say, he spent most of his time working in town, and we were pretty much out on our own inventing trail construction as we went. A few close scrapes with the chainsaw, but we got by. We would go up, and the portion of the trail that we really had to work on was the lower portion of the trail in the forests, because it's temperate rainforest up there. It would get overgrown pretty quickly.
Ah, okay.
And so we did a lot of work just trimming things out and putting in sections of corduroy planking and that sort of thing to get the trail across boggy places. And then we did have to build a few bridges, and
like you know, 10 foot long pieces of wood, or longer than that.
We would actually have to cut trees down,
okay,
and cut them up and build a bridge. They certainly weren't works of art, since we were making it up as we went along.
Hmm.
We knew that dropping trees was dangerous,
right?
And fortunately, we had a come along, and so we would. One guy would climb up the tree as high as he could and attach the come-along up there, and then we'd brace it lower down and start pulling on the tree in the direction that we wanted it to fall.
Right.
And then we'd make our cuts, hopefully doing it right. And
the tree would fall on the come-along, and you'd have to eventually rescue that.
We would. The trick was that we would sit there and we'd get everything together, and then we'd have one person on the chainsaw, one person on the come-along, and everybody else far away. And the person on the chainsaw, as soon as the tree started to really move, you could hear it start cracking.
Yep.
We'd quick kill the chainsaw, run away. That was the signal for the person on the come-along to take a couple quick last cranks on the handle and run away as well. And then wherever the tree came down, why, then we'd use it from there.
Okay.
This would have, if OSHA had been on the books, this would have been an OSHA nightmare. but like I say, we got through the summer without any real serious.
I can hear the superintendent saying, "Let's hire some park technicians for the trail crew. This will be great." Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. we got through the summer. We got through half the summer.
Mm.
We'd done a bunch of work, put in some bridges, and that kind of stuff, but nobody was really very happy with the way the situation was working out, and so they were looking for other jobs. And along about the end of July, I guess it was, everybody on the trail crew quit except me, and they'd found other jobs in Skagway,
huh.
Work in the tourist trade. And so
oh, interesting.
There's little old me, and my boss is, well, you know, I can't have a one-person trail crew. And he really didn't want to spare any of his laborers from trying to save these historic buildings.
Right.
And he said, well, you know, we got this archaeologist up from the Denver Service Center. He's doing some work. Why don't you go over and help him out?
Oh, wow.
And so I went over and helped out the archaeologist for the rest of the week. And
what was the archaeologist doing?
He was kind of interesting. He was doing excavations around the historic buildings in town.
Hmm.
Let's see, how to make a long story short here. Basically, the Park Service had bought some of the historic buildings, and the Park Service had also bought some lots, but the historic buildings weren't on the lots that the Park Service owned.
Okay.
In many cases. And in other cases, the historic buildings were on the original lots, but the foundations had all decayed away. And so what they needed to do was excavate around the buildings, either A, to be able to jack the building up and build a foundation under it,
right,
concrete or cement, right, block or whatever, or to drag the building away to one of the lots that the Park Service did own.
Got it.
Which sounds kind of bizarre from an archaeological standpoint. It's kind of like, why would you drag a building off of its historic lot and put it someplace else? But as it turns out, over the history of Skagway, people were dragging buildings all over the place. Practically nothing was where it was originally built, because all along people had been, oh, I'd like to move my house over to that lot. And so they'd wait until wintertime when the ground was frozen, and they'd drag their house over to a new lot.
Wow.
So it was, you know, there was some logic behind it. And so I'm helping the archaeologist work on this stuff. And his name was Dan Martin, and he was up from the Denver Service Center. And he was watching us work, and he said, "You seem to know something about this, you know." And I said, "Well, yeah, I actually kind of like minored in archaeology in college." He goes, "Oh, really?" And so he asked me to. He said, "Do you have a copy of your transcripts?" And of course, I was a seasonal. I always had a copy of my transcripts along because I needed mm-hmm. them to apply for my winter jobs. And so I said, "Yeah," I brought him in the next day. And he says, "Oh, this is great. I'm just going to put you in charge of a crew."
Wow.
And so he would put me in charge of a crew. And sometimes it was a crew of one. He'd just give me an assignment. and sometimes it was a crew of five or six people.
Okay.
And we'd be going in and digging around. And
but that play, would free so, him up to do more work. Okay. So he must have been very happy.
It freed him up to do more work, or he also started touring around Southeast Alaska a little bit more.
Okay.
He's, "I'm going to just leave you in charge." So I'm, you know, we're doing all the excavation, and I'm, you know, bagging up the artifacts. And
what sort of stuff were you digging up?
Well, that was the interesting thing. The guy I was working with, he had trained in Southwestern archaeology, and so we were doing what's called historic archaeology. You know, nothing that we came up with was older than 1898.
Right.
And most of it was a lot younger. And he said, "Yeah, you know, I know this work is really important and we're documenting the history of the town, but to me, this stuff just looks like trash."
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's broken plates, broken glass, you know, this, that, and the other. I remember one time I spent all day doing some test pits along a wall that we needed to move. And at the end of the day, I came on some glass at the bottom of my test pit, and I took a look at it, and it was safety glass from a windshield on a car.
Oh, my gosh.
And they didn't even start putting safety glass on windshields on cars until the 50s. It wasn't even historic.
Yeah.
So I've been carefully excavating my way down through stuff that had been probably churned up within the last 20 years.
Wow.
So it was kind of a weird situation, but it was fun. And so I worked through the summer, the rest of the summer up there. And then the end of the summer came.
For the archaeologist.
Working for the archaeologist. It was pretty much my full-time job. Every now and then I'd have something else to do. You know, they'd need a hand hanging drywall. And being 6.5 feet tall, I was a good.
Your
a good
services were in much, much demand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We'd had a hiker come down the Chilkoot, and there was one suspension bridge that was on the trail, predated us. We had nothing to do with it, but he took some pictures and sent them to the park. Apparently, some of the cable brackets on the suspension bridge were installed backwards.
Ooh.
And it's really not a good thing. So one day I did a 16-mile day hike to Canyon City and back to switch all the cable brackets around so they were straight on the suspension bridge. Stuff, you know, so it wasn't all archaeology, but it was a lot of archaeology. And and then during the course of the summer, they moved us from one of the buildings we'd been in to another historic building that actually had been an old house of ill repute. It was kind of a fun place, but the plumbing didn't work.
Ew.
And so we could sleep there, we could cook there, we could actually take showers. The shower worked. It was just the toilet that didn't work. But we had a yard, and the park offices were above the grocery store next door. So, you know, if something came up, either we'd pee in the yard or we'd run next door to park headquarters and run upstairs and use their bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out just fine because the trailer that was next door was unoccupied. So we had plenty of screening.
Okay.
When we were going in the yard until the chief ranger moved into the trailer.
Oh.
And within the week, the plumbing got fixed in our house.
Good.
It was really, yeah, just get the right person in the right place at the right time. And so in living in Skagway, it was quite an adjustment coming, you know, from Arizona. We, one time, the longest stretch we had where it didn't rain was 4 days.
Wow.
And the longest stretch we had where we never saw the sun was 2.5 weeks.
Wow.
It was, we could take off, go hiking up in the mountains, and with all the daylight, we'd get off work, and then we'd hike up into the mountains, do a hike, get back at 10 o'clock at night, because it still wasn't dark yet,
right. And
go to bed.
Huh.
And it was, I would get up there, and one time my little backpacking stove wasn't working right, and I was up on the tundra, and I thought, well, of course it's not working right. The altitude's so high up here, it's just, I'm sure the carburation's off. And then it dawned on me, no, I'm not even 2,000 feet above sea level.
Right.
I just need to, I might be surrounded by tundra, but no, I just need to clean this thing out really good.
Huh.
So.
What were some of the neatest things you saw, either working on the trail or digging in archaeology, from the Gold Rush days?
From the Gold Rush days, there were, you know, we would see lots of, you know, just mundane artifacts, you know, broken pieces of crockery and glassware and that kind of stuff. But there were, I think the neatest stuff was just the environment. And one time we went up to the White Pass City, up above Skagway on that trail, and they wanted us to do a quick survey to see just what was left in town. And so just going through the woods, and it's a temperate rainforest up there, so it's, you know, not as lush as what you see like in the whole valley at Olympic, but still pretty lush, you know, moss hanging off the trees and all this kind of stuff. And then looking real closely, you would see the foundations of these buildings.
Oh, wow.
And you could see the streets and all that kind of stuff. And,
huh. And
just to think that, you know, okay, there used to be a town here, and if you didn't look closely, you wouldn't even guess.
And now it's all overgrown.
Yeah.
Huh.
The one thing that was kind of interesting was that we were finding some artifacts, but we didn't find as many as we really expected, you know, things like, you know, old cook stoves and that kind of stuff. And so we came back into town, and we'd be hanging out in the bar or whatever, talking to the folks. And I said, oh, yeah, we, you know, for years, we would just, if we needed something, we would just go up to White Pass City and rummage around until we found it and bring it back into town.
Hmm.
So, yeah, there's no stoves or anything up there. We hauled all those out a long time ago.
Interesting.
So it was kind of ransacked. We had one instance where a bear had been bothering the hikers at one of the little rest cabins on the Chilkoot Trail, and so they said, you know, we're going to as you're coming down the trail, we want you to meet with the patrol ranger, and we want you to scare the bear off, and he'll have some firecrackers and stuff. So.
Hmm.
So we met the patrol ranger a little ways above Canyon City, and we were stopping to clear some fallen logs off the trail. And then we come around the bend, you know, 100 feet further on, and there's the bear sitting there in the middle of the trail, even though we'd just been doing all this chainsaw work.
Hmm.
So he was pretty comfortable, or she actually was pretty comfortable around people. And so the patrol ranger, Tim, lit one of the little firecrackers, tossed it at the bear, went off. The bear scampered off, got about, oh, maybe 50 yards away. This was a black bear, not a grizzly.
Hmm.
Stood up on her hind legs and looked back at us and started loping back over towards us again. So it's kind of like, okay, this isn't good. So we're standing there trying to get the chainsaw started, just in case. And he lights the whole rest of the string of firecrackers and throws it at the bear. Just by luck, the firecrackers went off, oh, probably about 6 inches from her nose.
Oh, my gosh.
And we never saw her again that summer.
Wow.
So So we were successful in that. So it was kind of a, it was an interesting summer.
Yeah. So
it was not one where the archaeology, doing the archaeology was kind of fun, but overall I didn't really enjoy the work, but I did enjoy being, you know, up there in Southeast Alaska.
Yeah. The location sounded great, but you must've been thinking, okay, I'm a seasonal. What am I going to do for my winter? You know, where's this going to go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, it was, and, excuse me, so the end of the summer was coming up, and it was also time, in those days, it was time to start putting in for winter jobs, and then the archaeologist said, well, you know, what I'd really like is for you to come down to Denver and do some of the lab analysis on these artifacts, because you know, you helped dig them up, you know the provenance on everything. So if you would come down to the Denver Service Center, I'd have you do the lab work on the analysis of the artifacts. And that sounds like a good deal.
Would that be a 6-month, 180-day detail sort of thing?
No, it was just a continuation on my existing 180-day.
Oh, okay.
Appointment. And so, so along about the middle of August, why we started getting everything packaged up to ship out, and that was right about the time when it was also getting dark enough at night that we could see the northern lights.
Oh wow!
which was very cool. We had a couple of just really dynamite displays.
Wow!
The next morning, everybody's got a stiff neck because they're staring up at the northern lights all night long.
Oh my gosh!
And so we got everything packaged up. And then I was going to, the patrol ranger had a Volkswagen van. He had driven in to Haines, the one town that was on the highway in mm-hmm. Southeast Alaska, and then put his van on the ferry and brought it into Skagway that summer.
Wow.
And it actually worked out great. He was supposed to be one of our roommates, but instead he just lived in his van.
Hmm.
So there were only two of us in the place. But anyway, he and I decided, oh, well, we'll drive back down to the States together. And so we had it all planned out. We were all packed up, ready to go. So our last night, we were sitting in the bar, and a bunch of, I should back up a little bit. All summer long, they'd been working on a highway called the Carcross Highway that was going to connect Skagway with Whitehorse. And so we'd driven up with Tim. We'd driven up on parts of the highway over the course of the summer. And so we're sitting there in the bar, and all these Canadian highway workers come in. Yeah, we say, "Where did you guys come from?" "Oh, we drove down." It's like, "Is the road done?" "Well, it's done. It's not open yet, but it's done." And Tim and I are going, "So it sounds like we wouldn't have to put the van on the ferry down to Haines, then drive up to the Alaska Highway. We could just drive to Whitehorse." And so we quick threw everything in the van, and at 10 o'clock at night, we took off and started driving up the Carcross Highway. And we got up to the part that we hadn't seen before, and it's kind of like, well, he said the road was done, but he didn't say the bridges were all done. So
ooh,
we're barreling through the dark, looking, hoping that we'll see if there are any bridges that aren't there yet, and across the international border, and eventually we came to a gate. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. Came to a gate across the road, all fenced off and everything. It turned out that that was the closure on the road. It was on the Canadian side because customs hadn't been set up.
Ooh.
So there was a construction camp right there. So we wandered around and found this guy who was drunk. And he came over and opened up the gate for us. So we drove on our way. And
wow.
The next morning we were in Whitehorse. And we're a little bit leery. You know, we'd see the Mounties driving by. And
they'd be looking at you.
No profile. we weren't sure if word had gotten out, but we as far as I know, we were the first people to drive from Skagway to the lower 48.
Huh.
And so we came down, picked up the Alaska Highway in Whitehorse, and drove down night and day. We drove in shifts, driving down through a little bit of the Yukon, northern British Columbia, across Alberta, down through Saskatchewan, and got to our last gas stop, and we had run out of Canadian money. And at that time, the Canadian dollar was worth about 90 cents U.S., but if you gave them a U.S. dollar in Canada, they would discount it. So they would take it, but they would give you, even though their dollar was worth less than our dollar,
right,
they would give us less than a Canadian dollar.
Oh, wow.
Direct dollar. So being a bunch of seasonals, you know, there was no way we were going to put up with that. So we scraped together our last, the reason we ran out was we spent too much at the McDonald's in Edmonton. It was the first McDonald's we'd seen all summer.
Woo-hoo!
So we scraped together our last remaining Canadian currency, and the one thing was that they didn't discount change, and so we scraped together all of our U.S. and Canadian change and came up with just enough money to get gas that would get us across the border into North Dakota.
Wow.
So we made it back down, driving across North Dakota. It was about 100 degrees. In Skagway, the high all summer had been 76.
Oh,
so
we wow.
And then he dropped me off in Grand Forks, North Dakota, went on his way to Michigan, and then I took a puddle jumper flight from Grand Forks, oh, I don't know where all we went, Minot, Rapid City, Cheyenne, Denver, but eventually got down to Albuquerque. My folks picked me up. I went and got my truck out of storage and redid all the stuff in my truck and headed for Denver to work at the Denver Service Center in the archaeology lab.
Nice.
And so they set me up. It was it wasn't in the Denver Service Center itself. It was in some space that they'd rented in another building on Union Street on the west side of Denver there. And I got to work analyzing the artifacts.
Where did you stay?
Initially I just kind of camped out in my truck up in the mountains.
Okay.
While I house hunted. And what I discovered was everybody wanted a 6-month lease.
Ah.
And I knew I was only going to be around for 3 or 4 months. And so I kept looking, but I kind of got into a routine of living in my truck up in the mountains and commuting down to Denver every day and back at night. And eventually got to the point where, you know, I don't really mind this that much. So I was homeless and just living in my truck up in a campground in the mountains. And then when the weekend came, I was all packed to go someplace, whether it be down to Great Sand Dunes or over to Canyonlands or up to Rocky Mountain or whatever.
Cool.
And so I wound up working until the end of December and never did find a place to stay, just lived in my truck and worked there in the lab doing the artifact analysis.
Okay.
And going through and doing archaeological type stuff, looking for the maker's marks on the glassware and the ceramics so that I could date it cleaning and stabilizing different artifacts and all that sort of thing.
Did the people in Skagway say, you know, the Klondike Gold Rush, say, be great to have you back next summer as a seasonal?
They did. It didn't work out. And so I got, at that time, you know, you could get, you know, not recommended for rehire, or recommended for rehire in competition, or recommended for rehire without competition. There were kind of three classes. And that was the one job that I got a recommended for rehire in competition. Because, you know, I was hired to work on a trail crew and I didn't know what I was doing. And so it was kind of like, well, yeah, you're okay, but we might be able to do better. So we're going to recommend you in competition.
Hmm.
And,
yeah, but for the archaeology work, you'd done better there.
I did better there, but that wasn't really one of their jobs. That was kind of a make do that worked out well for me, but it didn't. It wasn't the way things were set up. And I had pretty much been. What do I want to say? It was very promising for me to come back and work in interpretation the following summer, and so I did apply up there, but I don't know what I did on my application, but somehow I screwed up my 171 form in such a way that they couldn't reach me because they wouldn't be able to rehire me. They were hoping to hire me in competition, but couldn't reach me on the register that they got. So that turned out to be my only summer in Alaska.
And so what did you apply for other places as well?
I don't remember what the other parks I'd applied for were, but I didn't get a position. And so my job ended at the end of December in Denver there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kind of hit the road. Let's see, how did that all work? I pretty much continued living in my truck, but now I was a tourist. I was a snowbird.
Okay.
And I actually audited a class, stayed with a friend of mine at Albright, and audited the 80-hour interpretive skills class that Albright had at the time, and stayed with a couple of old friends, slept on their couch in an Albright apartment. I spent, oh gosh, over, spent a long time in Death Valley. I don't remember just how long. I had finished the class at Albright, and it had snowed tremendously while I was there. And I just used to pile up snow in the back of my truck to have better traction in the snow. So then I left Albright, and I went over to Catherine's Landing on Lake Mojave. It's kind of like, oh, I'm going to go someplace warm. And so I pulled into my campsite, and the first thing I did was start shoveling snow out of the bed of my truck into the campsite. And the people in the next campsite were standing there looking aghast, and finally walked over and said, "Where did you come from?"
Oh, my gosh.
Stayed around, explored around Lake Mead a little bit, that's right. I had applied at Great Basin National Park.
Okay.
Or actually, it was Lehman Caves National Monument at the time, and didn't get a job there. I went up to Lake Mead, and they had a roadside tour where you could rent a cassette, and then it would give you a guided tour along the North Shore Drive up to Colville,
okay,
and on to Overton. And I thought, well, that'd be fun to do, but I'm broke. I don't have a job or anything else. I'm going to see if I can get this for free. So I go into the visitor center and I tell them, you know, I'm Park Service and I take the set without renting it and all that kind of stuff. He goes, oh, we could hire you. Here's the cassette, but I bet we could get your application from Lehman Caves. We need a patrol ranger at Boulder Beach, and you're a big guy. You would do great. And it's kind of like the last thing I wanted to do was be a patrol ranger at Boulder Beach.
Did you have an idea at the time what Boulder Beach was and its relationship with Las Vegas and the Hells Angels and that whole scene?
I did. I knew exactly what I would be getting into if I was at Boulder Beach.
Wow.
And the guy kept insisting, no, let me go get my AO. And so he laughed to go get the AO, and I just took the tape and ran.
Wow.
And so I toured Lake Mead, narrowly escaping a seasonal position on Boulder Beach. Went up to Valley of Fire. Woke up the next morning, and the ground was covered with snow.
Wow.
I'm like, no, I'm tired of snow. I'm going to Death Valley. So I took off for Death Valley, went over the pass, dropping from Lathrop Wells down to Furnace Creek, and it was snowing up there at the pass. It was snowing at the Donnie's View Junction. It was snowing when I got to Badwater. Everybody was so excited that snow was actually sticking to the ground and stovepipe walls.
Oh my gosh. You were like, no.
Fortunately, it was just a one-day deal at the bottom of Death Valley for the snow. But I wound up spending at least a couple of weeks, maybe longer, exploring Death Valley, and gradually fell in love with the place. And went down to the Copa Game Range in southwestern Arizona, went down to Organ Pipe National Monument.
Nice.
Eventually, the checking count was getting low, and I stopped by Petrified Forest, and they said, oh, you know, we need somebody. Can you do an emergency 30-day hire? And I said, you know, sure. And so they hired me on an emergency 30-day hire, and I worked the entrance station. And that's when my rejection from Klondike came through. They said, no, there's just no way we're going to be able to hire you. And so they're Petrified. They were still filling up their seasonal rosters, and they said, didn't you send us an application too? And I said, I don't think so. And they said, I'm pretty sure you did. I can't understand why you're not on this roster. Could you fill out another one right away? And I said, yeah. And so I did. And not naming any names or anything like that, why I wound up with a seasonal laborer job at Petrified Forest for the summer of 19, what would that have been? Summer 1979.
79, yeah.
And so I worked as a laborer in Petrified Forest, mostly cleaning restrooms and picking up trash.
Okay.
Spent the summer of 79 doing that. Then the summer that winter, in the fall, I had sent out applications, and they picked me up to work at the combination fee collection and interpretation down at the south end of the park at Rainbow Forest. And so I spent the winter working down there. And I believe that was the winter I redid the exhibits at the Rainbow Forest Museum.
Okay.
They mostly had exhibits that were kind of a mishmash of CCC and Mission 66, and they were kind of outdated, needless to say. And so I got out the old Leroy lettering set, my old pal from the Painted Desert Inn days, and made up a bunch of new labels and rearranged the display cases and all that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
And I was in the back making some labels, and the ranger that was out in the working the desk came back and said, there's this guy out here who says that some of those new labels that you're making are wrong. And I said, well, I copied him right out of the books, right out of the museum collection notes. Who is this guy? He said, well, so he runs back out and says, who are you? Comes back. He says his name is Sidney Ash. Well, I knew the name Sid Ash. He was probably the world's leading Triassic paleobotanist.
Wow.
And I thought he was dead. It turned out he was not. He was very much alive and not even that old. So he came back and we sat down and talked about a bunch of stuff. And I was able to do a much better job on the labeling.
Nice.
For the rest of that work. So
was that the only time you ever met him?
No. When I came back to Petrified Forest in later jobs, I'm not done with that part yet.
Okay.
I worked quite a bit with him.
Nice. Because I'll definitely want to hear some Sidney Ash stories.
So I worked through that job, and I'd sent out my seasonal applications again. I finally got to the point where I could usually do a seasonal application and wind up with a job between the experience that I had and that sort of stuff. And so I got picked up for my summer season for a job in Death Valley.
In 1980.
Yeah, for the, this would have been the summer of 1980. And seemed like a good deal. It was going to be doing tours of Scotty's Castle. And I kind of went into it with open eyes that, okay, I'm going to be in Death Valley in the summer.
Summer. Hmm.
But at least I'll be indoors because I'll be doing tours of Scotty's Castle, which will get boring after probably about 3 weeks.
Right.
But at the same time, Death Valley is such a neat place. I want to go there. I think this is going to be really great.
Hmm.
So I accepted the job. And then 2 weeks before I was supposed to start, they called me up and they said, okay, well, we just got our budget in from the regional office and we can't hire you. We don't have money. It's kind of like, you can't not hire me. My 180 days here is about to run out.
Right.
And they said, sorry. And so I immediately started looking around for other work. And it turned out that the Forest Service had not finished filling out all their fire crews for the summer in northern Arizona. So I sent an application to all the forests in northern Arizona for an emergency announcement that they had just put out. And the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest hired me to work on a fire crew out of Heber. And so they called me up. They offered me the job. And I said, well, how soon do you want me to start? And he said, well, we'd like you to start tomorrow because that's when we're starting our training. And it's kind of, well, I don't know if I can be there tomorrow. So I went and talked to my boss. And he said, no, you can't be there tomorrow. But we can, if you can put them off until Sunday, that'll be fine. So so I quick packed up all my stuff, threw it all in my truck. Saturday I worked at the entrance station. And Sunday morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, I left Petrified Forest, went down to Heber to get there in time for work the next day, or that day. So it was one day working at Petrified Forest and the next day working for the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest.
And this is the summer of 1980.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. You know what? Let's call this would be a good place to wrap up this part here, because I'll definitely want to know about that summer and about fighting fire there.
Okay. That sounds good.
All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part 3, Oral History with Carl Bowman. Today is Sunday, November 8th, 2020. And Carl, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Tom.